A very warm welcome to everyone. My name is Eric Neumeyer. I'm the Pro Director of Faculty Development and a Professor of Environment and Development here at the LSE. So on behalf of the London School of Economics and Political Science, I'd like to welcome you to this, let's call it pre-event, of this year's LSE Festival, New World Disorders, a series of events exploring how social science, now I kid you not, my speaking notes say, can't tackle global issues, but I think that's a Freudian slip. I think it must mean can tackle global issues. Yes, this is the third time we have hosted BBC Radio 3 Free Thinking at the festival. We're delighted to have them back again. That's if you wonder what this technical apparatus is there. LSE Festival 2019 will bring together global thought leaders to continue our investigation of the big challenges that society faces today and how the systems that bind society together need to evolve and adapt. We're expanding our focus to look at the shifting geopolitics of our times, the disintegrating democracies, reconfigurations of identity, and technological transformations. How did we get here? What are the challenges? And importantly, how can we tackle them? In the run-up to the festival week, we have started a debate on social media about the threats and opportunities of the future, sharing some of colleagues' views on the best case and worst case scenarios in their fields. We plan to continue this discussion throughout festival week, leading up to our closing event, New World Order 2035. Can we imagine together a better world? Do join in the debate using the hashtag LSE Festival. The festival itself runs from next Monday to Saturday, 2nd of March, and you can find the full program on our website /festival. You'll also be able to catch tonight's Free Thinking, where it will be broadcast on Wednesday on BBC Radio 3, and will then be available as a podcast from BBC Sounds, which is when I will hear it, because unfortunately I have to leave after this introduction. I'm very sorry for that. Tonight's event, therefore, is hosted by, or is moderated by, Anne McElvoy, who is senior editor at The Economist, presenter of BBC Radio 3 Free Thinking and BBC Radio's 4 Moral Mace, one of my favorite programs, and the London Evening columnist as well. So please join me in a warm round of applause for our panelists.
Thank you very much indeed, Eric, for that warm welcome, and lovely to be back, I should say. We'll be underway in just a moment, and do save up your questions as we go along. We've got a couple of points for you, and we'd love to hear from you as well tonight. We often hear that we live in a post-deferential age, and that public trust in politicians and elites more broadly is waning. Yet we're also seeing the rise of strongman leaders around the world, and a popularity of those who stridently battle for their own view. To hell with the naysayers. So what's the difference between power and authority and authoritarianism? And are new forms of authority and leadership emerging in the worlds of politics, government, business, and technology? We're here at the London School of Economics and Political Science for a special edition of Free Thinking, recorded in front of an audience as part of the LSE's Festival of Ideas, which explores the theme of new world orders and disorders. And we'll be asking how social science can tackle global issues, how did we get here, and importantly, how can we address them and close the gap between those in authority and those at the end of the process. Joining me on stage are 5 people well-placed to analyse our love-hate relationship with authority and where it might be heading. Mary Caldor is Professor of Global Governance here at the LSE. She's written widely on globalisation, civil society, democratisation and modern conflict. Louise Casey has held numerous public positions, including head of the Respect Task Force, the UK's first Victims Commissioner, Director General of Troubled Families and Director of the National Antisocial Behaviour Unit. Heather Abatz, a former barrister, was the youngest local authority chief executive running the London boroughs of Lambeth, Merton and Hammersmith and Fulham. She was executive deputy chair of Millwall FC and the first woman on the board of the FA in 150 years. Jamie Bartlett is author of Radicals and The People vs. Tech, He's also a technology industry analyst at the think tank Demos and an alumnus of the LSE, like Heather. Rupert Reed is Director of Research and Strategy at Policy Exchange, previously based in Downing Street, a special advisor to the then Chief Whip, Gavin Williamson MP. So let me use my small amount of authority and ask you for a round of applause. Let's explore what legitimate authority looks like in this era of disruptions all around us when the old establishment certainties are being questioned anew. So what's behind the perceived crisis of authority and who's lost out? Louise.
I suppose my starting point is I'm not sure it's quite as much of a crisis of authority as sometimes the public discourse says. I mean, we're in the London School of Economics. There are plenty of positive authority figures in education. In fact, there's one on the panel with us tonight. If I think of some of my lives where you're dealing with people who've got multiple problems and multiple issues, then actually a positive authority figure in their social worker or their housing officer. My GP is a positive authority figure in my life in trying to get me to do the right thing. So I think in a day-to-day way, I think we are perhaps overdoing the fact the world has gone to hell in a handbasket and actually there's no positive authority out there anymore. That said, Anne, and I'm sure we'll come to it later, I think there are really fundamental issues where we have lost trust and faith in things like banks, large capitalist organisations, companies, as well as politicians and politics. And I think that is a different crisis of authority, but I don't think we should think that we've all given up on the idea of authority. We may question it more. We may be more challenging of it. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but I don't think it's gone out the window.
Mary, I think you've written that people don't trust political institutions, or at least they don't trust them in the same way. But where's the evidence for that, and what do you think is being lost?
Well, I think Brexit is a very good example of loss of trust in our institutions. I think a lot of people voted for Brexit because it was an anti-establishment vote. So I think we're seeing, and this is borne out by opinion polls, a pervasive loss of trust in our political institutions and in our politicians. And I think this is to do with the fact that our political authorities haven't kept pace with the sweeping economic, social, and cultural changes that have happened over the last few decades. Our political institutions are actually unable to respond to the kinds of demands people make, partly because many of the important decisions that affect our lives are taken far away, in financial markets, in the headquarters of multinational corporations, in other countries' carbon emissions. And partly, I think, because our institutions have got stuck in an earlier era and are rather rigid and inflexible, and our political parties have turned into electoral machines instead of transmission belts from the citizen to the top. So for all those reasons, I think, we've lost trust.
That's a very good survey, and I think we will be digging into some of that later and what might happen next, what might remedy it. I thought, but I would come to you, coming from the political class, not so long out of the heart of the political machine. We're talking at a time when we've just seen the foundation of a new independent group of breakaway Labour MPs. Chukwuemeka, one of their number, says, politics is broken. Is he right?
I think what he's getting at, and we've touched on it already, is the loss of trust of people in the ability of politicians to deliver on their promises, to affect the change that they want to see. We've seen the rise of quangos, for example. A great amount of power is vested away from directly elected politicians. So, for example, if you look at something like the NHS, NHS England, it is run by experts. We touched on Brexit. We heard a lot in that debate about the role of experts, and people had enough of them. If you vote for something, you vote for a change, the ability of a minister to affect that change, from environmental policy through to health policy, actually it's very difficult. And you combine that with your job being decided by somebody thousands of miles away, And people start to wonder how much ability they have to control their lives through
where
voting.
They fit in. Yeah. Jamie, technology is your bailiwick inter alia. When I put the question, who gains, who loses, where do you see the sort of balance now in the disruption of technology in terms of authority?
Yeah, I think technology's played a pretty significant role, actually. I mean, if you think about it, we used to have our gatekeepers that used to look after information for us. People like you, actually, you know, editors at big newspapers.
Is that what I do?
Encyclopedia Britannica and all these different places that we could lean on in an era of information scarcity to sort of navigate the world on our behalf. And obviously now we all have access to practically infinite amounts of information, and so we have to navigate it ourselves. And there's lots of wonderful things about that, but I think part of the problem is we're sort of struggling to work out how we find new sources of authority in that much more democratic media world. So, for example, we trust Uber to get us home. We trust that because we trust the peer rating system that it runs on. So authority sort of seems to lie more in our peers than in the authorities that we once believed in. But yeah, part of it, I think there's a deeper problem here that chips away at authority. When you are surrounded, as we are, by infinite information choices, it feels like every single decision that's ever taken is contested. You can always find evidence and information that X was wrong and Y was lying and so on. And I think what that does actually is really sort of chips away at people's confidence in how decisions are taken.
Heather, when we look at a lack of trust in leaders or anxiety about the lack of good leaders, I think it would be fair to say that's just it's a long-standing complaint, but it seems to be very widespread at the moment. Are those leaders lacking, or is it simply that public trust has waned in the same quality of leadership that we would have once accepted as pretty much par for the course?
I think that the models of leadership are changing, and that old models, going back to some of the comments Mary made, that the models of certain types of male politicians who are absolutely ingrained in party politics, that I think that sense of leadership from them is waning. But actually, if you look across, I think, the spectrum, you see new leaders and movements emerging that are hugely powerful. So I've just become chair of Time's Up UK, you've had Me Too, massive sort of shifts in views around the behaviour, around what constitutes safe working places, mobilising millions and millions of women. So I think leadership is much more, and authority is shifting in a whole host of different ways. On one level, liberated by access of information through technology. But also, you know, information and knowledge are very different things. We still search for people to give us a sense of leadership, who speak with authority because they have marshalled that information and can convey knowledge, and that is different.
Louise, you've worked in and around government across the political spectrum, but I think when we first encountered each other, you were working with the new Labour government at the time, and I'm struck by the fact that now, when people look back on that time, the point, the breach of trust, I think it would be fair to say many of them remember, is the Iraq war, or a sense that despite any justifications that something was lost then and trust was a sort of lost byproduct, if you like. Is that, you think the way that trust goes, that there are just certain things or disruptions that come along and you lose it, or is there something else underneath that?
I think there are emblematic moments that symbolise really those sorts of changes. But I think that what we're, you know, I probably think the first thing that Tony Blair should have done was set up his foundation rather than that mean the second thing that he did. So the first thing he is characterised as doing is actually going and making lots of money out of his position as Prime Minister. That's kind of what people believe happened. And actually he did go and do that. He should have actually gone straight and set up the foundation and made a very sure commitment, one that was around something that wasn't about money. And the Iraq war, I think, is caught up in that moment, actually. It's interesting. And I think that, you know, when you think about it, Anne, some of this stuff is so deep set. So the beginning of when did banks think that they didn't have to be regulated and they could take risks with people's money, and then you see pictures of people queuing in places like Newcastle and Sunderland and Redcar outside building societies, panicked, a bit like that moment in the film It's a Wonderful Life that lots of people watch at Christmas, where everybody piled in the building society saying, I want my money, I want my money. And, you know, I think that that's really the beginning of things like that, the idea that essentially large corporates and particularly the banks, the building societies, the insurance companies just got fatter and fatter and took more and more risks around people's daily lives. At the point then we had an expenses crisis, as it were, again, use the word crisis, where actually MPs were seen to be taking the mickey, really, in terms of actually not seeing that they had a kind of a responsibility towards the public for every single penny that they get in terms of money. So I think there are lots of things that were symbolic and continue to be symbolic. Can I just pick up on the point you made about Chuka Amuna yesterday?
Yes,
I thought it's fascinating that, you know, I think it's a really interesting moment that we have this independent group. I think politics does need a shake-up, and I think the Labour Party needs a shake-up. And, you know, God knows what's happening, frankly, with the Conservative Party. They probably need a bloody good shake-up as well. You'll edit that out, won't you? But, you know, kind of the whole thing's a mess, really. One looks it all.
Not unless you really want
to. No, I'm very happy for it to stay in. I'm known for strong language. You know, the thing I would say is I thought it's fascinating that Chuka said this is the end of politics as we know it. Of course it's not. He doesn't really mean that. You know, essentially this is a way of putting a marker down about, you know, we've got to do politics differently. And if that means politics has to breathe integrity and truth, then I'm up for it. If this is fiddling around with things, then I'm not, really. And I think what they've got to be careful about now, people in politics, is pulling the wool over any member of the public's eyes is going to be a real, real, real mistake.
I feel I should let Rupert come and have a word about that. But if you could just put it in this context, or at least bear this in mind, the milestones, Louise chose some, and all of our milestones would be selective. Some of them would cross over, some of them wouldn't. Did you recognise the kind of milestones towards that demise in authority, distrust that Louise put? Would you choose your own? And of course, feel free to have a word about the independent group. It does seem to be in the air as a subject.
I think what Louise touches on, which is interesting, is the need to reform political parties. You say the Conservative Party needs a shake-up, Labour Party needs a shake-up. We've seen the rise of extremes in politics in recent years. So, what is it, 2 to 3 million people who've never voted before voted for Brexit. Jeremy Corbyn comes along and suddenly the Labour Party is the largest political party in Western Europe. Those are both arguably extreme choices, extreme results. I think people were increasingly fed up of not necessarily seeing the difference between the two main parties. And when somebody comes along and offers something that's extreme, it's exciting and it garners support from a certain group. The challenge for Chuka's group, and we'll see how it goes, will be to differentiate itself, I suppose, from any of the mainstream ideas that have seemingly been rejected.
It's in one way, it's already, or at least at the moment, it's anti-authority. It doesn't have a leader. What do we all make of that? I mean, I'm sort of old-fashioned enough in political studies to think, actually, there's always a leader, even if you say there isn't. But am I wrong? Anyone? Does it matter if there isn't a leader?
Well, it's very unclear what this independent group is. Yeah. It's very unclear what they stand for. It's very unclear whether they're going to be a movement.
But does it matter that there isn't a leader?
I don't think it matters at all.
If I have anything... Sorry.
Well, I was going to add something. I mean, I just wanted to come back to you on what you said on Tony Blair, because I just think the Iraq war was a terrible tragedy, and we're living with the consequences with the war in Syria, the war in Yemen. It started something terrible. So, of course, we lost trust, whether he'd chosen a foundation or to make money. But the other thing I wanted to say was about extremism and shaking up. I mean, I think the huge expansion of the Labour Party was a sort of shake-up of politics. But the problem that we have, and I do think this is, there's a different kind of loss of trust than the loss of trust over something terrible like the war in Iraq. It's the loss of trust in these politicians who seem to be desperately trying to please the exact right voters.
But there's a loss of authenticity, isn't
a
there?
A loss of authenticity. And the weird thing
around
is,
Jeremy Corbyn.
The weird thing is that everyone gathered around Jeremy Corbyn because he was authentic. Or I don't think,
allegedly,
by the way, he was extreme. If you look at the Labour Party manifesto, it was much more moderate than the manifesto of the Labour Party, say, in 1964. So I don't think he was extreme, but I think what's happened is he's turned into another politician.
Exactly.
That's the problem. And the people who voted for him, who expanded the Labour Party, were expecting a new type of politics. Yeah. And it hasn't happened.
Well, a new type of leadership.
That's
where it's failed, because he's now caught up in the same political discourse that others have been.
Exactly.
And therefore, you know, is Shuka trying to reinvent a voice in politics which will not fall foul of that?
Let's move on, if we could, from that. Feel free to chuck it in, but from that specific political example, small p parties and breakaways. Jamie, you wanted to come in, and I couldn't help thinking, as this was all rolling out, well, one great difference, if one's comparing Mary's point to the 1960s, is, of course, technology is in the mix, whether we like it or not, and in often what seems to be a dominant position. You even frame your argument as the people versus tech.
Yes, and I actually think what might be going on here is a bit of a crisis of the idea of representative democracy. Like, why do we need to have representatives doing stuff for us when we can do it for ourselves? I'm not saying that I agree with that, but it's the first time since ancient Greece that a direct democracy is actually possible. I think when you look at Brexit and you look at, for example, the five-star movement in Italy, or you look at what's going on with the Gilets jaunes in France, a lot of it, I think, is part of that tension. We don't need representatives. We, the people, we can decide directly. Why should we have to give our authority up to somebody else? This, I think, is actually quite a problem. And I also think it's become a real trademark of the populist left and right to say, all authority rests with the people. Everything has to go back to the people. The people are good and wise and smart and just, and the establishment up there is mean and stupid and cruel and malevolent.
But when you call a book The People Versus Tech, you would seem, unless I'm hearing it wrong, to be somewhat on the side of the people when it suits you.
Yes, I think this shift towards more and more styles of direct democracy is actually quite disastrous. I don't think it's good at all. I think it's extremely tempting, but I don't think it's going to lead us to solve any big problems. Why? Partly because the minute you put everything to direct democracies, as we've seen, things become binary, things become divisive, the idea that, for example, a referendum will definitively solve a problem for a generation, I'm afraid that is not the case at all, probably the opposite.
Just in case we come across as maybe a group of elites gathered at the LSE, does anyone want to put in a word for direct democracy or the power of the people to speak, so to speak, from the gut?
Well, no, but I mean, seriously, I mean, it's not. I think representative democracy has to be massively improved. I think it's gotten far too distant from the people, but it doesn't mean that we should introduce more forms of direct democracy. But I think this is the big tension, essentially, that technology is bringing on.
Jamie has that's a really good point to put down here. I mean, call me old-fashioned, but last time I checked, I want every single person in this country to want to vote and want to believe in democracy, a hard-fought democracy for many people, particularly women and others in this room. So, you know, if we could have a mass movement back around democracy, I'd be a happier woman, frankly. But
I mean, a lot of people think that is what happened in the Brexit referendum. Maybe not many of you, if any, on the panel, but that is actually what a lot of people did think they were taking part in.
Which is a good thing, that more people turn out to vote. You know, one of the worst things is where you have low turnout, because it has such a degree of apathy and people have given up. But one thing that we must recognise is happening in terms of, you know, tectonic plates shifting, is in this country the divide between the rich and the poor is just too great. Okay. That the idea that austerity hasn't bitten, you know, Rupert, I take issue with your we've handed out too much responsibility to experts and quangos. I wish we had. You know, I wish that they put a bunch of technocrats in charge of Brexit rather than leaving it to the polarisation of politicians that can't agree on the outcome that seems to be best for the country. Just the very nature by which that Brexit referendum was run was the worst of politics. It was the worst of creating hatred and creating division.
If people
by
had
lines.
Been happy with the technocrats, we wouldn't have been there. Maybe Ruby could have a word.
Yeah, well, so the thing I must just get across, though, the point I want to make is, you know, if people are living in poverty, you know, working poor, people who are working and poor is getting higher, that cuts to the issue here about the rich and the poor being too divided. And some of the Brexit vote, some of what's happening in this country is about that. And unless we heal the country, unless people come together around making sure, you know, the benefit system should not be a punishment system, you know, housing should be available for people that need it, we shouldn't have homeless people on the streets. I mean, those are the things that we need to coalesce around, whether it's Rupert, whether it's me, whether it's Heather, whoever.
Rupert.
Firstly, I would say there is certainly a place for an appointed individual. Yourself, Louise, are a great example of somebody appointed to drive through an agenda, be it tackling homelessness, troubled families. There is certainly a role for that. The problem comes, I think, when the most corrosive thing is when you give people a choice. I think referendums are a terrible way to go about governing a country. But if the elected representatives decide to abrogate the responsibility and hand the decision over, the worst thing we can do for our politics is then to decide, oh, we made a mistake, you made the wrong choice, and then try and overturn it. That is something that will lead to a real crisis of authority.
I'm just going to ask you all to sort of keep focused a little bit on authority, because I can see that we could have an enjoyable question time here about any number of the subjects you just had. But I think, Mary, you looked like you wanted to come in, and then I'd like to ask Heather a bit about business. She's been quiet for a few minutes, and we know that she knows an awful lot about how business plays into this. So, Mary first.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I, as an expert, as an academic, I do think there's also a crisis in expert knowledge. And what Brexit revealed was a huge distrust in the experts. Mm. And there's a reason for that distrust. I mean, I think particularly economics has been dominated by these neoliberal doctrines that justified austerity. And there's a reason why people don't trust what economists say.
It this sounds is like not. You, but hang on, I'm just going to challenge you a bit, Mary. It sounds like when you see that, I thought you were going to say something interesting there about experts find it harder maybe to get a very complex world right. But you found it only on one side of the balance, so you went shooting straight for the big neoliberal word. Do you ever see it on the other side too, or is that, do you genuinely see it as pointing
well,
one way?
What I think is that in every phase of history, we have a kind of dominant paradigm, a dominant, you know, the expert knowledge fits into a sort of dominant discourse. And I think what happens is that at crisis moments, we have to question the way we've analysed the world. That's our job. And usually the people who question the we call them the critical thinkers. The critical thinkers usually have a hard time making their points and getting them across. And what we and what they usually become the dominant thinkers of the next era. So I think there's a moment when we're in crisis, and it's not simply a crisis of politicians, it's also a crisis of expert knowledge. And while I completely agree with those people who say direct democracy is not a good thing, we need experts, there is a problem when the experts are saying things that people feel very uncomfortable
about. Yes, and are seen as part, perhaps, of a liberal project. I mean, I would have thought perhaps more of a left liberal project. You might say you think there's too much of a, you know, the assumptions are run to a what you would call a neoliberalism or a very strong capitalism, but that there's a conflation between liberals and experts. Does anyone observe that, particularly in the use of the word?
I wouldn't say liberals. I mean, I'm a liberal. I believe in liberal values.
Yeah,
I believe in social justice as well as political justice. But I think what has happened is that economics, in a way it wasn't in the 50s and 60s, has become completely dominated by an obsession with markets, which has legitimated great degrees of inequality and austerity.
I must come to, speaking of markets, actually, I must come to Heather and the role of business leaders. And we tend to sort of pick off banks and politicians. We usually get those out of the way in the first 15 minutes of these events, right? Feel free to come back to them, of course. But business leaders and where they fit into this, the views of business often seen as a touchstone. You find a lot of people who might otherwise not think they want to put a lot of faith in business will go running to them to the sort of pronunciation on Brexit or something else. Is it, Heather, that we're looking for a corrective to democratic politics, and should we listen to business?
I think we absolutely should listen to business. I think what we're searching for are, as I say, voices of not only authority but authenticity. One of the crises around experts is that many feel that they're not in the real world. They're not in the world of either poverty or of hard work, but they are people who opine on these matters from a very great distance. Business leaders are seen to be closer to the nature of endeavour, and we all know that in terms of any redistribution of wealth, you absolutely have to engage with business. And you know, some of the leadership of businesses are absolutely driven by people who now recognise that they have to engage both their employees as shareholders or view their customers in a very different way. And therefore, the language, particularly of some of the younger entrepreneurs coming up and through, is much more resonant. In going back to a point that Mary made at the outset, institutions and party politicians feel increasingly a long way away. If you've just set up, you know, some of the really successful tech companies that you see run by people in their 30s, these people are a million miles away. They don't speak to us or, you know, whether it's women or diversity or youth. They just have no connection. And I think that is the crisis that's going on about why those institutions are almost incapable of reforming themselves and why business at times, not always, and we know there's lots of frailty, but there's frailty everywhere, why some of those business leaders capture popular imagination.
That's interesting. And in terms of that, I think we just pick up on that point that you put so well about if you've grown up with that, if you've been sort of part of that going on around you and you look to a political classroom, but social media seems most relentlessly hostile, actually, to the political class. It's a bit self-selecting, the echo chambers. You get through a day on Twitter and think you might actually, you know, like to venture outside it by the end of it. But it has changed a lot, hasn't it? Because a lot of people who simply are more at home in that world than they are, perhaps, with the old-fashioned idea of a representative democracy. Am I right?
I think there's certainly something in that. Policy Exchange, we've done quite a lot of work on the rise of incivility, as we've called it, which essentially seeks to chart the rise of personal abuse from experience by people of all political persuasions that has been made much easier by social media. Before, you could read something in the newspaper, watch it on television and shout at the newspaper, the television or perhaps the newspaper. Now you can directly tweet somebody within seconds of reading it.
You can do both, as I've found. It'd be very enjoyable when you tweet and shout at
and the at a public meeting or something like that, there is a level of respect generally.
So this incivility as a challenge to it might be that you had a lot of civility before, which was kind of servile. Do you understand that there might be a sense that, well, we've actually been civil for too long and not much worked out to our advantage?
I think there's obviously a difference between healthy and rigorous political debate and debate more generally and insults and othering and not engaging with the ideas but attacking the person and the individual.
But there's a difference,
and that goes into identity politics.
There's a difference between deference and about respect and about how you treat other people.
Yeah.
And the scary piece of the anonymous face of technology is that you can say the most disgusting things and get away with it. It is those attitudes that have to be challenged. And clearly there are issues around the platforms and their own levels of responsibility. But that, I think there is that distinction.
Absolutely.
The tech man cometh.
Well, I think deference can more easily turn to disdain when you are constantly surrounded by what you consider to be obviously true because you keep reading it and then come into clash with somebody who disagrees with you, and they must be either stupid or evil to not agree with me because I've just spent the last 6 weeks looking at this stuff over and over. But I think something, in a sense, more fundamental is going on here. So When you're completely surrounded by information, like I said before, you can only deal with that at quite an emotional level. But it's too much to deal with the sort of facts and the charts and the blogs at a rational level. So we come to rely on our emotions and our feelings as to what we trust. And I think in that world, you trust yourself more and more. And I think that is what is driving a tribalism in politics, where authority comes from sort of loyalty to the group. This is the reason why, despite us always saying it's the end of deference, we have the rise of the tribal leader, the strongman politician. Why? Because politics is becoming more tribal. Why? Because that's the only form of politics you can have on social media when you're constantly surrounded by conflicting views.
I want to just make a possible dissenting view. I mean, it seems to me that the tabloids were very good at expressing incivility. And I felt quite strongly in the last election that because people were going to social media, the tabloids were less influential. And, you know, you can make an argument that the social media are what people make of it. So, of course, there's fake news, of course there's echo chamber, but there's also greater knowledge, there's also greater deliberation. And, of course, we need to regulate the social media companies and make sure that really horrible content's not there. But at the same time, I do think it offers a lot of possibilities for greater deliberation.
Louise, I wanted to ask you about the role of younger millennials. I mean, millennials are now such a long category, it's got such a long tail, I'm just about qualifying myself, actually. But particularly sort of Generation Z, at the younger end of that, the digital natives we've referred to, do they have different views of authority? And indeed, Generation Z, as in the audience, might tell us in just a moment. But what do you think?
Well, I think the most extraordinarily positive thing about the millennial generation is how much they seem to care for their fellow man, and that social conscience is just much, much more a deliberative part of how they want to see their lives, whether they're working in private business or whether they're in the public sector or whether they're a volunteer or whether they're a startup tech person, that you see throughout the evidence that they have a very, very, in my mind, thank God, healthy approach towards a social conscience that puts the rest of the generations to shame, frankly. And can I just come back on something that Jamie was talking about? I think this sort of, this, well, it's all part of the same thing, actually, that, you know, if you have the opposition Chancellor of Exchequer, John McDonnell, talking in such extraordinary terms about potentially the way people should be treated if they're not on message with his party, no matter what he said about Esther McVeigh, he's also used incredibly strong language about other people. And so that legitimises then this outpouring of hatred by all of the people that then they might distance themselves for. The same way if Jacob Rees-Mogg thinks it's a pin-up in the 21st century to somehow have a badge of honour that he's never changed one of his child's nappies, then he should be ashamed of himself because he's just emblematic of something which is out of step with where the rest of us expect men and women to be in this country who have children. So if that's their starting point, in very different ways, I could say other things about leading Conservatives and the language they use. But my problem with it is they are leaders, and they are appalling leaders in the way that they're allowing people then around them to essentially behave even worse and even more destructive ways. And that's what worries me.
Just before we go to the audience for some questions, because we have quite a lot that we can chew on there, I just thought, Rupert, one thing I wanted to ask you about was, this is some of the work that you've been involved with, the policy exchange on the crisis of lack of authority and how this, sorry, in schools, I should say, lack of authority in schools and how that negatively impacts on outcomes, at least in the view of some of the work that you've done. But then, what is the answer? Because it's easy to say we've lost authority, we've lost authority towards the young, we've lost it in schools, we've basically lost it quite a lot of time around at my house, actually. But at the same time, it's not such an easy thing to put back in the context of all of these disruptions and challenges that we've heard. Just give us a flavour of that, and then we'll go to the audience.
I mean, taking it back a step, part of the theory or the philosophy behind it was the idea that there's been a great deal of focus on individual rights in over the past few decades, and, you know, for good reason, you know, be it minorities being abused or women, particular groups suffering from whoever was in charge. That then has proceeded apace and perhaps too far. So the focus on the rights of the individual child who's misbehaving to the exclusion of the rights of the class to learn. So we did some extensive polling of both teachers and pupils and also parents and found the level of disruption caused by an individual pupil was holding back in entire classes. What one can do about it, on that very specific example, was teachers no longer felt supported by senior management to discipline a child. So the concern was that the head teacher was too worried about, say, negative publicity or a parent kicking up a fuss and the trouble that would cause, rather than supporting the teacher in the classroom in the decision they took with what was going on with that individual child.
And that's a specific argument about schools, and I'm sure people will have views on that. But, Louise, if I was to say to you, because this is something you're very strongly associated with, and that's something like the Respect Task Force, and that idea of respect and where it might differ from authority or be a kind of rebirth of authority if you're dealing with, well, kids on the streets or actually being, you know, much closer to a world where there isn't a formal authority figure. It's not just the balance that Rupert described about how you manage a school or a classroom. Where do you think authority now fits in that?
Well, you know, there's an irony here, which is I think that, again, if you think about the popular culture and the use of the word respect, that is seen as a positive word, and it's about integrity and truth. And I think, you know, yet again, one has to bow down to the fact, thank God, people that come after our age group actually have some brains and actually are working their way through this for us. You know, and I think that we get very caught up in particular words. I mean, I ran the Respect Task Force, which is a very Blairite approach to this, because actually it became clear that people were living with very high levels of antisocial behaviour, noisy neighbours, rubbish in the streets, low-level crime, and the system couldn't respond to that. And that's what that was about. It was trying to push back and say, we have to respect each other and that we have to do that properly. And when you break the rules, there are consequences. Just a very quick one, Rupert. If the government hadn't pushed through with the austerity agenda, we might still have a raft of teaching assistants that were able to step into some of those spaces. I agree with some of what you're saying, but I think we can't underestimate the fact that some of what has been out there, including, you know, in the streets, in neighbourhoods that are poor, we used to have money for things like neighbourhood watch coordinators, people who were members of the public that get, you know, we had community crime fighters, we had a bit of a youth service occasionally. Mm. You know, those sorts of things, you can't, if you take that glue away, when you've put that glue in, more importantly, when you remove it, I think that has bigger consequences. In a way, it was almost better not to put that glue in the first place, so those people in poor areas could...
But also about the calibration around the relationship between trying to get a collective sense of responsibility, neighbourhoods, as against the individual rights. And it was about trying to set up a different equilibrium, and once you take that away, then everything absolutely goes out of whack. And I think that's one of the challenges that we now absolutely will have to deal with. I think the other is about leadership.
Yeah.
I think leadership is so important, which is different. You know, you see leaders in many, many different ways. Patrick Vieira, if anybody loves their football, was a great leader on the pitch. Might not have had authority, might not have worn the captain armband. He had great leadership. Leadership requires courage. It requires that head teacher to say, not in my name is this going to happen. Mm. And stand up to press, bureaucracy, and say, this is what we do in this school. It is about having the courage to exercise leadership and judgment. And there is a real crisis.
Mm. Jamie, sorry, I keep promising we'll go to the audience, but what a loquacious panel we have. Jamie, last word to you.
Yeah, I think, so when it comes to the internet, I think parents and teachers have lost a bit of authority because such a gulf has opened up between the experience of young people online and the people that are supposed to, or that are tasked to teach them and help them through it. I mean, I don't blame the teachers for that. They weren't taught about life online when they were doing their teacher training course. That hopefully changes as the years go by. But I think as a result, what you've got is a lot of young people who realise that the people that are supposed to teach them don't actually know what they're talking about, which is a really serious problem. But thankfully, Louise mentioned this already, a lot of them are pretty savvy. Young people... young people are much better at spotting fake news than older people. It's the over 50s that are sharing fake news. It's not people aged between 16 and 24. But they definitely do need a bit more guidance about how to be sort of smart and wise online, and there's not enough people out there to show them.
Right. Let's get a bit of advice and guidance, but preferably a pointed question from some of our audience. Oh, my goodness, lots of them. So I'll take this lady at the front first. We have a microphone, which we'll need to get to you. Thank you. And then I saw a hand there as well.
Just cough. My question is about, you started off with talking about a crisis in authority with the Iraq war. But we've also had, talking about crisis authority with banks, politicians, potentially police, education, businesses. Do you think this could be helped by people in those positions learning to say sorry? We seem to be living in a culture where the people in authority don't like to say sorry for anything or admit any accountability or weakness.
Good question. Very, very quick fire, and only anybody who really wants to, because I want to get a few questions in. Who'd like to have a bash at that? I was going to say Mary, just because she mentioned Iraq and is a specialist on the region.
Yeah, I think it's terribly important to say sorry, and I think this is a particularly gendered thing. I think men tend to find it very difficult to say sorry. And I would go back to what Heather said about authenticity. I think there is a real sense that, you know, politicians measure their words thinking about the polling and who they've got to satisfy instead of saying what they really think.
Right. Another very quick thoughts, anyone on that?
With such a frenetic media circus, you can more easily get away with not saying sorry because the whole thing charges on and it's all forgotten about tomorrow and the cycle just changes very quickly. So I've really noticed an uptick in the last few months even of politicians not even acknowledging when they've made a factually incorrect statement because everyone will forget very quickly.
But it's not just about mouthing the words, it's about the meaning behind the words. It's like if you say sorry, then what is it you're going to try and avoid doing next? I think if you just say sorry because you think it's going to get me out of this piece of trouble, that's not going to work. It's about why you're saying sorry and whether you've learned anything.
Louise, very quickly, because I'm going to take a couple of questions and I think we can spread them around. I'm just aware that the clock is moving on, but you did look dying to come in. So.
Well, I just think it's an absolutely fundamental point that it's almost impossible, particularly for politicians or any other leaders, to say sorry and really mean it. I did the inspection into child sexual exploitation in Rotherham Metropolitan Borough Council. It was one of the most challenging and difficult things I've done in my life, not just my career. And I found it absolutely extraordinary that people found it impossible to say, look, we got this wrong. I also found it really interesting that the bloodthirsty desire for me to name names so people could be hung out to dry was equal. And I think that, you know, one of the hard things, I think, for those of us that really believe in public service and in doing, I believe in the state, I believe in public service, I think that we have a role as a state and society to look after each other, is we need to get beyond this. And I think some of where we're at with, and I don't think there's a crisis of authority, I think there's a crisis around leadership. People shouldn't always be sacked because they screw up.
Let's just be quick on these if we could. Rupert?
Just very briefly, one, seeing as we're at university as well, one very high-profile apology was Nick Clegg's almost tearful video he made to apologise about, you know, the pledge on tuition fees. Didn't seem to do him much good. I mean, I'm sure there are lots of other reasons why that happened, but it doesn't always work.
It is a fair point. If things are not rewarded somehow, I mean, we don't do them on the whole. Right, let's take a couple more questions. And I mean, there are two hands there, so if you take the microphone up there and whoever gets first. Take three, she says. Producer's getting antsy. You're also interesting. Wait, we need to get some more questions in. Come on, then.
OK, I mean, I was just wondering, I feel like I might have grown up in a parallel universe to people on the panel, because we talk about this crisis of authority and era populism. I grew up in England where the IRA, in the United Kingdom, when the IRA were fighting and the loyalists were fighting in Northern Ireland, where we had bombs going off everywhere. That didn't strike me as an era of conformity and respect for authority. Paisley, I assume, was a populist. Thatcher, and there might be a virus here, was a populist. And I just, I've lived in the United Kingdom, I lived in Italy, and I can't think of anywhere where I've lived where, you know, this era of conformity and respect for authority ever existed.
I think it's a great challenge. Being present dayist? Keep that in your minds, people.
It's nonsense. And I would also say...
Very short.
I would... Good I can't question. Imagine coming to a meeting like this 20 years ago without heckling. You know, I've been sitting here so nicely and thinking, what? This wishy-washy nonsense, really.
Right, noted. Heckle. That's heckle of the evening to the gentleman there. Next person behind him. Feel free to...
Thank you for the talks. I'm a Chinese undergraduate student. So my question is about China. Will China model be thrived and widely replicated by other countries in the future, since the Western democracy become less and less salutary for dealing with global and domestic issues? Thank you.
Well, it's a viewpoint. Next, we'll put it to the panel. Who else would like to have another run at it? Yes, a lady with her hand up.
Can you hear me?
Yes, okay. Go for it.
I was just wondering if there was any value in separating political leadership from state institutions, and whether in this era of populism, what we're witnessing is either a waning belief in political will of leaders, or rather a disillusionment with democratic institutions that don't have the capacity to implement the vision people are supporting.
Right, so we have the last question, which you just heard, so I don't need to repeat. We have the China model, full-throated recommendation, and is that, given that we have described systems in the Western world, which you seem to be at least doubt-ridden, if not crisis-ridden, about authority, and what have I forgotten? Oh, yes, my friend, our heckler in chief, who says, actually, he doesn't recognise this sort of look back to authority having been as intact as we perhaps assumed that it was. And I'm just going to throw that out to the panel to take a one or bit of those, and just quickfire, if you could. Who's raring to go? You look like you are, Rupert.
Just on the present dayism, I take the point that certainly things were lively in the past, be it in political debate or in terms of bombs going off, although obviously we do have some of that today. I would say what has changed, though, is the ability of the public, and particularly on the social media, to direct hate directly at an individual. So Jacob Rees-Mogg or Angela Rayner Diane Abbott will receive hundreds or thousands of pieces of direct hate mail online every day. Before, say, 30, 40 years ago, you might have got a few death threats in the post during the week. Not great, but I think there has been a material shift. Whether we learn to deal with that and that changes, I think we are going through a change now. So that the rise of technology is certainly upon us.
Can I get you to leave it there? Yeah. Is that fair? It was an absolute bonmo, your Oscar Wilde moment, or you could have it on the next round. China model and sort of political leaders, and that, I think it was someone used the phrase earlier about like a transmission belt that seems to be failing between the leaders and those they're supposed to lead. Who would like to just comment?
Well, I think there is both a crisis of authority and a crisis of leadership, and the two things are connected. And I think the crisis of authority is very much about the fact that our hierarchies, whether it's in expert knowledge or whether it's in political hierarchies, are just no longer fit for purpose because we live in a much more interconnected, communicative, complex world. And we really have to rethink those models. And I think the crisis of leadership is a consequence, actually, of that we end up with leaders who are sort of caught up in the old institutions and don't seem to be able to rise above them. And I take your point about the IRA and all the things that were wrong 20 or 30 years ago. But I think this, to me, feels like a crisis that is more like the period before the Second World War than at any time in post-war history. And I'm quite old. And so I do remember things. It just feels it's more deep and systemic.
I'm just going to ask very quick thoughts of anyone else who'd like to come back. It's a very interesting batch of questions, and I think we probably need to
I could almost tie them together because
I mean, I think the whole edifice of the way we've set up modern liberal representative democracies is not really fit for purpose for the next, certainly for the next 20, 50 years. That's why the two-party system in a lot of countries is collapsing, and that is new. That isn't as it was before. We have had polarised politics before, but I think most people involved in politics say it's never been this angry, this emotional. Statistics show that trust in political parties, membership of political parties, trust in the media is lower than it's been for a very, very long time. And I think all of that together actually does suggest that a model like China might be something that people begin to look to. Highly centralised power, huge use of artificial intelligence and other types of machine intelligence to control society, to make sure that things kind of keep ticking over, the economy keeps growing. And that worries me, actually, because I think it does present a serious threat to democracies.
Last couple of comments.
Well, I mean, my starting point is I don't think... I remember the 1980s and the Labour Party, and, you know, the fact that Derek Hatton has now re-entered the Labour Party is kind of an extraordinary moment that was lost in yesterday's media.
But every country in Europe. It's every country around the world. It's not just about the 80s in the UK.
No, but what I'm trying to say is I happen to agree with the gentleman, which is that use the word crisis has to be kind of just put in inverted commas, because actually I think that at the end of the day, you know, frankly, God forbid, but even if there's a no Brexit deal, people will get up the following morning and go to work. People will eat their porridge if they eat porridge. They will get on with life. And it, you know, that isn't, you know, oh my God, no, the world's going to fall apart. It won't be great, but people will carry on. And people have always carried on, particularly in this country. Can I just take something up for a second, which is, so this world that's highly interconnected and everybody's talking to each other and it's all very global, you know, doesn't translate to some of the areas that, you know, I really know, places like Rotherham, where actually people are working poor. They see the queues for everything, like housing, like going to the hospital, like getting their kid into the school that they want, get longer, not shorter. They don't feel part of this world that they look at on the television. They don't relate to their MPs anymore, because people aren't speaking that language. It doesn't feel global in Redcar. It won't feel global right now in Swindon for the people that are looking at the fact they're now unemployed. You know, and I think that that's where, sorry, I'm using the wrong tone, it's not quite Radio 3 and it's not free thinking, but it's quite hard not to sort of...
It's called free thinking.
It is free thinking, because I just feel we're completely out of touch with those people and their lives.
But actually, I think it is global. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I was in Mansfield, which is a deindustrialised, demining area. So what's the new economy? It's Sports Direct.
Indeed.
With huge numbers of immigrants and people from Eastern Europe. I'm not against immigrants, by the way, but it changes the nature. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've lost jobs to all over the world. So, of course, it's global. It may not feel global.
I think you're at the end. There's a disconnect and a connect between the global and the local.
Mm. Same with the technology, though. The technology is sweeping everywhere. I mean, the transformation, how people consume news, how they communicate with each other. That is Redcar to London. I mean, that's everywhere.
That's a big Teutonic shift, and that's why I think we are living in a world which actually is so unknown. And we're trying to modernise and reinvent old institutions from a different era. And it is about a fundamental rethink. It isn't about fiddling at the edges around new types of political party leaders. It's something radically different.
And if I could just say something about the China model. If we're going to adjust to the something different, we have to have a flexible democratic model.
Yeah.
I was hugely moved by all those school children who walked out of school to protest against climate change, and that's what we need if we're going to adapt our institutions.
I think
that just isn't possible.
Interesting. I mean, that's a great... That's certainly not so easy in an authoritarian state. I wonder if it's a grey anyway. What do you think, Rupert? So you walk out of something to tell other people to do something, and then what? What do you think?
I actually disagree. I think that's not a great example of how to conduct public discourse. On the environmental issue, though, I think a good example would be the kicking that the Conservatives got at the last election from younger people. In droves of about 90%, people voted for somebody other than the Conservatives under the age of 25. And that has had an effect, and it's changed policy. You've had a raft of things from, you know, banning ivory trade, Michael Gove's always, you know, wandering around picking up plastic from the ocean and the shores. The government can't do enough on this agenda. And that is, I think, in direct response to the democratic pressure that they got.
You're listening to a special edition of Free Thinking at the London School of Economics as part of a series of events here exploring new world orders and disorders. If you'd like to catch up on some of our other discussions, do sign up for the BBC Arts and Ideas podcast. Right, well, let's move onwards a bit. And there's just some things I would like to dive into a bit more. And I'm going to go back to Heather on this, which is the business community and the idea of experimentation that's taking place in many businesses and in industry away from hierarchical command and control models. Perhaps not so surprising to Mr. Schumpeter or those who think of businesses as disruptive, but then we've also got used to thinking about the chairman's office and the board, and we sort of think we know what a business looks like. Is that what you see, and you do get around in a lot of
businesses? I see increasingly different models of leadership, and I think that command and control structure is fading rapidly. It is still there, but at that sense of how do you engage internally in your business is hugely important, about flatter structures, smaller, empowering people to make decisions. It is happening, and some of the old industries are suffering because they are not adapting fast enough. There's also something that's slightly interesting, I find, in the new tech companies, particularly the big global behemoths, which is they're almost cultish. You know, if you go into almost. Apple and Google, yes, Google, Facebook, exactly. You know, they've been, you know, people are. It's amazing. You walk into those buildings and you want to belong instantly, but it's scary as hell on many different levels. It sort of takes me to the China question, which is actually you have authority unbelievably exercised in what looks like very free-flowing tech companies, and they're not like that at all. In fact, they are very different. I mean, I don't know if you'd agree.
Yeah, no, I'd completely agree, and I think it's one of those good examples of where there's a lot of sort of progressive-sounding language about flat hierarchies, but in the end, there is a power system in there, and it's usually the founder at the top who's a guy who really makes all the decisions. And in a way, that sort of weirdly reflects how technology companies have turned out as well. We all thought they were going to be inherently democratizing, they were going to turn monopolies into markets, and yet that hasn't happened at all, really.
But do you see them changing at all when you get around in Silicon Valley and the various Silicon Valleys of different countries? Do you think, is that message getting through? Because they're right in the zone of public enemy number one, yeah, just after the politicians right
well,
now.
Well, you see, this is the thing. I mean, you look at the statistics of how much people trust some of these companies, and it's incredibly low, which is weird because we carry on using them all the time.
Yeah.
So it's a very bizarre situation. We find ourselves in almost resentfully using these companies that we've come to rely on so much. But you know what? It's a bit different now, because when you used to go into the big tech companies a few years ago, it was really sort of, we're great, we're saving the world, we're not like the man, we're different, we're cool, we come to work in a T-shirt, we're not capitalists. But it's slightly different now. They feel like they're under threat. They realise, you know, they are causing problems that they didn't think were their fault. And so I don't get quite the same positive vibe.
I'm not saying
that
it's
I used
positive.
To.
No,
yeah.
Exactly. I don't
well,
think
yeah,
you the, get, no, I think you get that sense of they've become, they're really defended,
yeah,
because they feel that sense of pressure, given that they've unleashed the pressure in the first
yeah
place. And so I think they're caught in a really difficult contradiction. But they're also hugely profitable.
Mm.
So though if you're a shareholder, at the moment it can all shift,
yeah,
but that model of leadership is working.
Well, I want to come up with another,
no,
or just bring up another model.
Well,
of,
Uber, yeah, well,
sorry,
Uber,
guys,
it's
we'll just
crazy.
Sorry, we'll
sorry,
talk
sorry,
across
sorry
each other. We'll just annoy what remains my authority. Another sort of world that I would just like to refer to, because Rupert has first-hand experience of this. You're a former naval reserve. Now, you might think that's a very hierarchical, very largely male culture that you've seen at first-hand. What's admirable about it, and what's frustrating, and perhaps do we not give enough credit or look for inspiration in authority structures which have persisted over time and might also have a reason behind that?
I think there is a difference between running an institution and exercising democratic control over a country. And again, actually, although we talk about, you know, sort of the authoritarian nature of something like the Royal Navy or other institutions, the Navy's motto for a long time was the team works. These things work better when you take people alongside and don't expect them to blindly follow orders, although, obviously, when you need to get something done in a pinch, you do require that. Can I just come back, though, on what we were just talking about, which is the rise of the tech companies? They've been compared to the oil companies of 120 odd years ago, and the reforms that eventually Teddy Roosevelt came to embody. Those big tech companies, which, as you say, you know, were so full of hope initially about do no harm and things, are engaging in exactly the same sort of anti-competitive practices. You know, I say this as somebody who believes in the free market and the power, and subscribes to some of those neoliberal beliefs that you mentioned earlier. But clearly, capitalism isn't working, and this feeds through to some of the crisis, I think, in leadership and authority that we see now, the people in red car, wages are stagnating. These companies are paying lobbyists to ensure they get the regulations that protect their businesses, that ensure that they can enjoy those profits that you mentioned. And they're using their power to protect their position and preventing competition.
You were a trust buster. You're a good old Rooseveltian bust the trust.
Teddy Roosevelt, certainly.
You could certainly. Teddy certainly, Roosevelt yeah. in your, yeah. not so new dealy. I think we need to move perhaps to the last area that we'll explore, and that is how do you lead in a time of crisis about leadership? Because I think we've heard a lot of informed critique here, but it would be a good time maybe to point forward. And I thought I would come straight to Mary on that one. I got the sense from you earlier, and this is a bit glossing what you said, that you worried about civil society, you worried about the sort of pushback from a raucous kind of plebiscite model taking over from the rule of law, from more deliberative spaces. What would your nostrum look like for dealing with that, for finding our way either back or forward to something that you feel is more helpful?
Well, you know, there's a distinction in, I hope I don't sound too academic, but there's a distinction in political theory between procedural and substantive democracy. And procedural democracy is about elections and the rules that we follow. And substantive democracy is about really being able to affect influence the decisions that affect our lives. And I think, you know, however good our deliberative processes, however good our procedures, if there actually aren't mechanisms through which we can influence the decisions that affect our lives, there's going to be huge frustration. And that's the situation that I think we're in today. And that's why I think we need both devolution. You know, people talked in the Brexit campaign about take back control, but I don't think when I went to Mansfield they meant Westminster taking back control. They meant themselves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's both creating political processes at local level, but also being able to participate in institutions like the European Union or the United Nations, or the WTO.
Assuming that they're responsive enough, which is quite a big assumption.
Well, they have to become more responsive too, and the way to get them to responsive is for us to politically engage. So it's not just a matter of these institutions have to be responsive to us. We have to be asking them for things.
Good. Louise, earlier you spoke actually in defence of technocrats. Is that the way, is that what this new leadership should look like? It's a serious question. You know, just sort of take a deep breath, everyone step back from your own anger, if you could find a way through politics to do that. Would that still be the right answer? Or would you think, you know, that worked, or in your view, worked for a while, but now we're asked about something else when it comes to leadership?
Well, I mean, I think technocrats means unelected people, and I don't necessarily think that's the case. But my own view about where leadership needs to head is it needs to step back and think about how it does heal the country we have a 50-50 split over one issue, which we all know is representative of something much deeper and slightly different to a one vote. And I think that the idea, you know, Sadiq Khan did a very interesting thing when he was elected as mayor. He went to Southwark Cathedral and he stood in front of everybody and he said, "I am the mayor for all Londoners, not some Londoners, not the people that just elected me, but all Londoners." And I think that somehow that got through your question earlier about what transmission, you know, does it get lost in transmission? That didn't. And I think that somehow, right now, it feels everything is ideologically driven, domestically. Everything feels ideologically driven, everything feels very tribal. And at some point, we need to move beyond that and have a discourse about what would heal this country and what will make it okay for everyone.
On behalf of the country, you don't believe that?
Well, I think I don't specifically, because what Theresa May hasn't had, whether she's chosen to do this or not, but what we haven't seen is any action on her speech outside Downing Street that said, "I'm going to make this country work for everyone." That is the sadness about the domestic agenda of this particular Prime Minister.
And that is the key issue about leadership.
And the key issue, I agree, Heather.
Going to call time because I feel that's a bit party political and it's a perfectly
it's
reasonable
point. It's about
what
you do. It's about what you do.
Let's just bring it quickly back, if we could, just to sort of where we are more broadly on the era of populism. A perfectly legitimate point, but I just feel otherwise, you know, I'll just be an impartiality hell on wheels, really. Ethics and diversity in business. I was interested in something you were starting to talk about before, so I just want to give Heather one point on this, then a couple of questions, then afraid we'll get a bit fast. What do you think about the idea that business, because it is, I've just come back from the heralded or much hated Davos meeting, and there is a sense business keeps telling me again and again it's putting more ethics, more diversity into its offer. You look quite sceptically at me, but I would say at least I'm hearing more that people think that it's very important to their mission. Is it window dressing? Is it forgotten when the plane takes off back from Switzerland? Or is there some sort of fundamental change going on here, Heather?
No, I think there's some fundamental changes. I mean, the new woman CEO of Virgin Money has absolutely pledged to having equal representation across the company. It is happening. It is absolutely happening. So I think increasingly we are finding that those words, and particularly in some of the current American corporations, are really pushing that change. It's been in part in recognition because they absolutely recognise that 50% of your population being absent from inside an organisation is just not acceptable. When all the women around the world walked out of Google in November last year about the fact that they did not have a safe place to work, that started to change the decision-making in Google. So I think we will see more of that happening. That is about how power is exercised by the many.
Speaking of the many, the very loyal many, a few quick questions before we finish. A gentleman at the front. I'm sorry, I didn't see you over there. There are my blind spots. We'll take a gentleman here, one at the front, and then anyone else, maybe a lady otherwise known as woman if we have one. Right.
Professor Cowder mentioned Mansfield and Dame Louise Casey mentioned Rotherham. If one was to get into a conversation in places like that regarding these massive capital spending revenue projects like HS2, like Heathrow expansion, Trident, wouldn't the immediate response be, how are we in these places, these rather depressed areas, how are we benefiting from those vast expenditures?
Good question. The gentleman over here.
Thank you. I think in the past years, we might have seen a shift of power from the national to the supranational level to organizations such as the UN or the European Union. So you could make a point that this might be a driver for the slogan "Take back control," because the decisions that are made in those organizations are beyond the control of the electorate. So in what way might we achieve a stronger participation of the citizens of the UK to those supranational organizations.
Great. One more? Any more for any more? Oh, there's one over here. So have you got a microphone here? No one else? Absolutely desperate, right?
Hey, yeah, I guess it was just from the panel's discussion about problems being based in kind of politicians to countries and constituencies or teachers to classrooms and the very hyper-local, and positives being about, you know, Uber and platforms that are quite transnational and have no boundary, it seems. But the problem being a tension of trying to even regulate at this kind of junction point. Do our solutions in this question need to be geographic and kind of completely agnostic about this question of geography? Right. Or is it something we can confront and accommodate?
It's a difficult one. I just have a quick technical question to my producer, my beloved producer. Could we wrap final thoughts from the panel into the answers to those questions? Would that work, production terms? I'm allowed to. You see how my authority figure lurks way at the back of the room. So, yes, we've got that sort of the junction point, as you nicely put it there, between the local, the hyper-local, and what that throws up, where would accountability lie there. We had that question about supranational institutions and where responsibility could possibly lie, and, you know, how would we ever kind of get to that? Inter alia, let's just, if you could, choose a question, and if you have a closing thought that goes with it, all the better. Mary Calder.
Well, I think I'm choosing, obviously, the question about supranational institutions. I do think we have to participate to a much greater degree in supranational institutions. I actually think there are mechanisms within the European Union. They ought to be stronger, but both through the European Parliament and through the Citizens Initiative, there are mechanisms, but actually we're so preoccupied with the domestic, we don't make use of those mechanisms. And I think there need to be more mechanisms, but nevertheless. But I think most importantly, I think that the job of supranational institutions is to create space at local levels, to protect the local levels from what one might call, I call, global bads, whether it's pollution, whether it's financial volatility, whether it's multinationals escaping taxation, so that people have the capacity to take more decisions at a local level.
Rupert, another question that was put was big infrastructure projects, the ones that get onto the news in the evening. What good do they really do? Some of the places who are much more challenged that were mentioned in our discussion tonight. Have you given that one any thought?
Dealing with Trident quickly, I think that, you know, the argument is that it provides collective security to everybody in the nation. On the HS2 point, though, and Heathrow, HS2 is directly aimed at helping to rejuvenate the north in particular, and the northern powerhouse idea. And again, Heathrow is justified as providing economic growth or a way to deliver economic growth. Whether they're the best ways to go around, I mean, I would actually argue they should have started building HS2 starting in the north and coming down, not starting in London. I think it sends the wrong signal, confirms everybody's worst ideas about, you know, London and how London-centric Westminster can be. In terms of wider thoughts, I'd come back to the question of agencies and people's agency over their own lives, and it comes back to taking back control, and it speaks to the idea of supranational organisations, and it's that if people don't feel they have the ability to affect change over their lives, they will become discontented and drift towards the offers of extremes, be it left or right. And so there is a difference between, say, having an elected government which can appoint an expert to deliver a particular project or objective, and having a whole area of public policy outsourced to either an expert running the NHS as chief executive or a supranational organisation such as the EU, the most elected elements of which are the least powerful.
If I could just ask the rest of the panel to try and wrap in the questions, but be a little bit delightfully brief, that would be very much appreciated, just on terms of the clock. You're all equally fascinating. Jamie.
More broadly, I think in the coming years, more and more important decisions are going to be taken by machines that we don't understand very well and might be based overseas as well in other companies. And it's easy to have a council of despair about this, and it's impossible to ever regulate them, but I think nation states can. They just need a bit of backbone. It's often not that difficult to set down certain rules, whether it's, yes, changing our antitrust law or putting down certain regulations about what content's available and not, but we need to make sure we do it and have the confidence in governments to be able to do that.
Heather. I totally echo that point, actually. I think it's hugely important. I suppose I think one of the areas I'm really interested in is the power of movements, that we are increasingly seeing people mobilise globally around certain changes. I mentioned the Google walkout. And I think, just as we've talked about how major institutions need to be reinvented, I think they also need to be aligned with a recognition that there are now movements where there are many voices calling for change and putting those changes in place.
And Louise, it's interesting that we ended up back with the local, the global, and the national was somewhat lost, actually, towards the back end of our discussion. Is that telling?
I think the answer to the gentleman's question about HS2 and Heathrow expansion has to be, for me, the answer to that question lies in the national, which is somebody at national level has to take responsibility for making sure that the goodness that runs from any of those developments is felt by everybody. It's the same way when politicians stand as government, they have to govern for all the people, not some of the people, and that flows then into taxation, it flows into public services, it flows into major projects that will benefit, making sure that somehow that benefit goes everywhere. And I think that's what central government's about, and that's what the state is about, and that has integrity, and sometimes the integrity has been missing, but we need to find it again.
Well, I can semi-authoritatively state that it's time to draw our discussion to a close, but I would like to thank my producer, Eliane Glazer, and all my panellists, Louise Casey, Heather Abatz, Rupert Reed, Jamie Bartlett, Mary Calder, and, of course, you, the audience.